Hi, Rich. This is Emma Schrader.
Hi, Emma. How are you?
I'm doing well. So great to finally talk to you.
That's good. You're on a speakerphone.
I am. Is that okay?
No, that's fine.
Okay. I'm going to ask if I can record you. Is that...
Sure. No, okay. That's fine, too. Yes. Okay. I expected that.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you very much. It's sort of awkward to talk on speakerphone, but it's the only way I've found to do the recording, so... I guess I'd like to start by telling you a little bit about my project and then ask for your consent to participate. I know I emailed you the form.
Yes, I have the form, and I'm not sure how to send it back to you.
Well, all I need...
Want me to just do a snail mail?
Well, all I actually need is your oral consent.
Oh, okay. That's fine.
Okay. So I just thought I'd send it along so you knew beforehand what I'd be asking. So I'm in the master's program in the geography department. As you know, and what I'm interested in academically, I guess, is a lot of things, but I'm interested in landscapes and food systems and how people interact with their surrounding environments, natural and otherwise. And I was looking around for a project, and my thesis advisor said, well, nobody knows anything about the Eagle Heights Community Gardens. And it's really true. Nobody's reported, has a comprehensive history of the gardens, how different people and communities interact in the gardens and how they have sort of been formed as a place. And so that's what I'm attempting to do in my research, and I hope that you can help me a little bit. So
you got to realize how long ago this was.
I do, but I think that any little bit helps, and you know more about it than I do. So,
1960.
1960.
I should probably tell you a little about myself.
Yeah, that would be great.
I'm now, and I can send you a resume if you like.
Okay, yeah, that would be nice.
I'll email you. I have a PDF file of a resume, mostly, and I have it in two forms. I'll send you both.
Okay.
One is a narrative resume, which is just the narrative. It's like a little story.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is the regular kind of resume with all the papers that were published and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, I would love to see both of them.
The narrative resume puts it in sort of in perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excuse me. So I'm presently a professor of chemistry emeritus and what's called an Arthur Thurnow professor at the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I've been here at Michigan except for sabbaticals since I left Wisconsin.
So wow.
I left Wisconsin in 1962.
Mm, okay.
Before that time, I was born in Berkeley, California, brought up in Berkeley. Native Californian. My dad is a native Californian. My granddad was in San Francisco at the time of the earthquake and fire. So
wow.
Long time California.
And you managed to leave California.
Oh, yes. I love California, but I like the Midwest, too. Mm-hmm. So it's fine. Different cultures.
Most definitely.
I went to the University of California at Berkeley, did my undergraduate there in chemistry. Mm-hmm. When I was about 8 years old, I saw a chemistry set in a store window in downtown Berkeley and said, that's what I'm going to do. And I really fell in love with that. And I've done chemistry ever since. I had a chemistry lab and in my home down in the basement.
Wow.
I lived about a mile from the university. The nurse of my family doctor was, her husband had gotten out of the Navy and was going to graduate school in chemistry, and she heard about me, and they sort of mentored me for quite a while. I was a winner in very early in the, what's called at that time, the Westinghouse Science Talent Search. And went to the University of California, Berkeley. They have a College of Chemistry there.
Mm-hmm.
Chemistry. When I got out of Berkeley, That was in 1956. My draft board told me I would be drafted soon, and I had been accepted at the University of Wisconsin and several other schools as well. I
mean,
but I didn't want to be drafted out of graduate school to go. This was a time of Korean War, and so I went to work for for Merck Sharp & Dohme in Rahway, New Jersey. It's a pharmaceutical firm, and I went there just as a bachelor's chemist, and I worked for them for about a year and a half or so, and then I was drafted into the Army.
Wow.
I served at, after basic training, I served at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research for 2 years, and at that point in time, then I reapplied to the University of Wisconsin and got in. The graduate program, and I came to Madison in 1959.
In the fall or the spring or
it
summer?
It was the fall semester, and I was married at that time. And we lived in we couldn't get into the university housing because it was so crowded, and they had so few units. And we lived over, I believe it was on Lowell Street. And then after a year, we did get into the university housing. And we were on, up in Eagle Heights. And I spent, because I'd done work, been a chemist when I was for such a long period of time, I had been a chemist while I was in the Army at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. I was doing chemistry there. I had a lot of experience, so I got through graduate school in just 3 years.
Wow.
So I was from 59 to 62, I was there, but only for 2 years was I at Eagle Heights. But when we got up to Eagle Heights, we were on Eagle Heights Drive, I think, in I'm not sure what it was. It's about 700 was the number. It was on the a curve, and many of the homes that were the apartments that are in Eagle Heights now weren't there. I mean, it was, and right across the street from us was this open field with some fruit trees in it, apple trees, things like that. And we decided that we would, my wife has always been interested in gardening, and we still have a garden in our backyard. And growing for our own food, that sort of thing. So we said we were going to just take this empty, go out in this empty lot, and see if we could, you know, we weren't making very much money, see if we could set up a garden for summertime and just dig up some more. So, this is not where the gardens are now, presently. This is, if you look at a map, it's, there's a Eagle Heights Drive is sort of a circle that comes off. I've looked at the maps. And it's right. It's nestled. And there were no houses or no apartment buildings at all. Heights apartments on the outside of that edge. And the gardens were placed in plots that were almost immediately below what is the Eagle Heights Mound, the big mound that has the Indian burial sites up on the top of it.
Okay.
And it was just to the south of that a little bit, and then to the east of that. And so we tried. We said we were going to just build there. Well, a whole bunch of people in the apartments decided this was a good idea. There was a huge collection of people that wanted to do this. And we decided then we ought to go to the university and see that we had permission to do that. We just asked the janitors there at the in the apartments at first, and they said, "Oh, sure." They weren't using it or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But then a group was selected, and I was not a part of the group. But Ian Wright, he was a chemist, mm-hmm. also in the chemistry department.
Mm-hmm.
I know was a major part of it, and I'm sure it was Ian that went on to to the administration and asked them if we could use that land.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who the person was that was involved at that point in time, but
mm-hmm.
he said, "Oh, sure, and in fact, we'll get somebody from the ag school to come in and plow the whole area."
Oh, wow.
And so they, at that first year, 1960, that's when it, mm-hmm. I'm sure it's when it started, that first summer, they came out, they plowed a huge plot of land. I think actually they took down some of the old apple trees as well,
mm-hmm.
dug it all up. Now, we didn't have water out there at the time. We had to bring water out in
mm-hmm.
pails at that
wow.
point. But, and then we as a group, and I was a part of one of those groups, set out plots so everybody had the same amount of land as some people
mm-hmm.
could get if they really had a family, or they could get two plots. It was very unorganized in a sense, but we
mm-hmm.
did have it set out so the plots were all the same
mm-hmm.
and people could start. And there were little paths were created with fences, very rudimentary fences
mm-hmm.
around on that very first year.
Mm-hmm.
And people started to grow. Now, we did discover that there was a spot up towards the Eagle Heights Mound that wouldn't support any growth. The first year, there was some sort of a spill of chemicals, ag chemicals of some kind,
mm.
That didn't allow the growth of any. So there were a few that first year. I remember there were a few gardeners who were very disappointed because they didn't get everything. But most people really well. The next year, we were involved in it too. We set out, and we tried to get, I think the second year, we tried to get, figure out a way we could get water over there, and I don't think there was, my understanding is that eventually the university supplied the gardens with a water line,
mm-hmm.
But that was after I had left.
Okay.
But, and we left in 62, and I came to Michigan at that point
mm-hmm.
in time. Ian Wright, when he finished his degree, I think he finished it a year after I did, Ian went was in Indianapolis, Indiana, with Eli Lilly Company.
Oh, okay.
And was a chemist, worked as a chemist there. I haven't spoken with him in 50 years.
Okay. The name helps.
But he was the one that, or at least a part of the group that went to the administration and got them to plow the field. And from that point on, the university did the plow every year. They would plow the fields and
mm.
get things going, so that the and they were very, very helpful. I mean, the
mm-hmm.
university just bent over backwards to make sure that people, when we were starting out,
mm-hmm.
to have these. And now, since that time,
mm-hmm.
that garden plot has completely disappeared. It's now filled with apartments.
Yeah.
University apartments.
Yeah.
And there's nothing there. And I know I can see that the gardens have moved over out towards Picnic Point.
Yeah. Yep. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's about the kinds of things that were grown. Tomatoes for sure. Everybody had tomatoes. There was always big discussions about which variety of tomato would grow best because the growing season was relatively short.
Mm-hmm.
and not a long growing season, so there was lots of competition about that. They had corn. Mm-hmm. There was, although we had some problems with raccoons coming down and getting at the corn.
Yep.
Beans, peas, lots of people grew things like onions, mm-hmm. carrots, potatoes. All of those were elements. Those are things that Ann and I still grow in our yep. backyard garden.
Mm-hmm.
And we've sort of given up on corn because of raccoons and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Groundhogs.
Yeah. corn gets destroyed by animals when
yes,
you try to grow it.
It's very hard. Unless you have a big field of it, they'll sneak in and decimate it.
It's true.
Raccoons can crawl over any fence you can
yeah.
construct to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we have great memories. My wife loved Wisconsin. I came back to Madison on a sabbatical in 1971, I think mm-hmm. it was. Yes. And I was there a year.
Mm-hmm.
In the chemistry department.
Yeah.
And we weren't in Eagle Heights, and we had five kids.
Not quite room in those apartments for five kids.
Yeah, no, there's no place. We exchanged houses.
Oh, that's a good idea.
We do, whenever we go away on sabbaticals, we either rent our house and we try and get somebody else's house
mm-hmm.
at the university that I'm going to.
Mm-hmm. Much more comfortable that way.
Yeah. I lived, most of my sabbaticals have been in Europe. I lived in Germany, in Aachen, Germany, for mm-hmm. a year and a half, and then I was in Zurich, Switzerland for
beautiful.
A year. Done a lot of travel. I was in Chicago at Abbott Diagnostics as an industrial sabbatical for mm-hmm. a year or two.
Fascinating.
Sabbaticals are great.
It's a great way of traveling and actually getting
oh,
to
yes,
see a place.
Yes. We've traveled everywhere. Yeah.
Mm. So you mentioned that there was a huge collection of people that were interested in the gardens. How did the word get out? What sorts of communication were happening amongst the Eagle Heights residents?
You've got to realize there was no internet.
I do.
No emailing. Mm-hmm. Well, let me. The way the Eagle Heights apartments were constructed, almost everything was by word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
There were sandboxes outside. And you'd go around and you'd place notices on the inside doors,
mm-hmm.
Inside the doors on the mm-hmm. The hallways. When babysitting was arranged in the following way, there would be four apartments that would have doors that were in the hallway,
mm-hmm.
two upstairs and two downstairs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And with a stairway going up,
mm-hmm.
when a couple wanted to go out, the couple in the next apartment, you just open the doors, and if you had kids, you just leave the kids in your own apartment, and you babysit by just having the doors open,
uh-huh.
so that you could, and kids would usually be asleep and be in the evening.
Yeah.
The other couple could go out, and the couple that was next door would be doing the babysitting.
That's great.
It was just such a nice community.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was, it was so simple because, and everybody was working hard and studying,
mm-hmm.
so there was almost always somebody around.
Mm-hmm.
And all you would do is, you'd open the doors, leave the kids in their own bedrooms and in their own apartments, and
uh-huh.
just had that community, that little group of four people, one of them would be present. You'd go downstairs and not say, I have to go out to the store for a while. Will you listen for my kids? And
mm-hmm.
then you'd go off. We had two kids, two of both of our older boys were born in Madison. By the time
mm-hmm.
we left Madison, I had two kids.
Mm-hmm. they help in the garden.
Yeah, plus the garden, yeah.
I'm sure when they were a year old, they were out there helping with the garden.
Oh, yes. Sure. Absolutely. So communication was mostly by, I mean, you got to realize, mm-hmm. Xerox machines didn't exist. Mm-hmm. You just use these devices that you simply make a print up a little brochure, and they were, you use the typewriter to type in a mask, and then you put it on a mimeograph machine, mm-hmm. and run it off. Mm-hmm. You probably don't know anything about that.
I've never used them, but I do know what they are. So
yeah, okay, well, that's what we use. And most of the time we would go down and use a mimeograph in the chemistry department, or mm-hmm. that's what I did, but other departments also contributed as well to this. That was very, it was very open, but the very few people had, we didn't have television while we were there. We did mm-hmm. not have, the only other communication was telephone, mm-hmm. Radio. That was radio.
Yeah.
That's just about it. Mm-hmm. Communication, as I say, mostly by word of mouth. People meeting at the sandbox with their kids,
yeah.
or out in the snow on this with the sleds. Uh-huh. they would then communicate. Said, "Oh, did you know that we're planting a garden for mm-hmm. again for this next summer? Mm-hmm. You sign up. Had to sign up for plots for a plot." For your garden. Mm. And people that didn't know anything about it just would hang around and watch other people, and then mm-hmm. and it was just a learning experience for most people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My family had a garden in California, very different kind of gardening process. My granddad had always had a big garden, mm-hmm. and so it was, again, it was for me, it was sort of the thing to do. My wife's family also had gardens. She was from she was from Vienna, Virginia, mm-hmm. and when we got married when I was in the Army, mm-hmm. and I met her when I was at Walter Reed.
Yeah.
And then she came with me, of course, to Madison. Mm-hmm. Big adventure.
Mm-hmm. Huh. What did you mean by it was a different kind of gardening process? Just the different environment from California to Wisconsin?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
No, the different gardening process. In California, the weather is, of course, you don't have snow during... in Berkeley.
Very different. No.
I think, oh, maybe occasionally there'd be a freak snowfall or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or out on Mount Diablo, there'd be some frosting of snow every mm-hmm. once in a while. But it's a very dry climate, mm-hmm. so you're watering all the time there. Mm-hmm. In Madison, you just let it, relied upon the normal summer storms.
Yeah.
To do the watering. Mm-hmm. It was a much more natural kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it did require that you take a little more care. The crops, the kind of crops that you would grow were a bit different in mm-hmm. Madison because they're not year-round kinds yeah. of things as they are typically in California. Mm-hmm. So tomatoes, you have to start all over the next year in California, usually. Mm-hmm. For me, it was a big change. For my wife, it was not.
Yeah.
She readily jumped to the even taking care of two kids. She loved gardening and mm-hmm. and as I say, still does it. She's mm-hmm. still an avid gardener.
Yeah.
The way in which you handle waste from the garden. Mm. In California, person, you could set up compost pile kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Because in California, it's so dry, things desiccate, and then there's no there's no decomposition. There's decomposition is much, much slower. So this is just very subtle differences can make a big change in the way in your practices for the gardening process.
Certainly. Did you have a you must have had compost. Did the gardens have compost?
Yes, they did. They had the compost bins. I think eventually what we decided is that area where we couldn't get anything to grow. The gardens weren't great. That's where we put the compost bins.
Oh. Okay.
And that was a practice to just turn them. You had three open bins. Put everything into one bin. After about a few months, in the fall, you usually turn it over so that it's aerated into the next bin, and it really rapidly decomposes. And then you shift it into the last bin, sift out stuff, and transfer it over. So it's a composting in Madison, as it is in Ann Arbor. It's very easy.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get rain,
and
things stay wet, stay moist, and all you have to do is make sure it's aerated to a certain extent.
Yeah. So you use that compost as fertilizer. Did you use herbicides or insecticides in the gardens?
I don't. And no. People really frowned on that. At least at the start. The reason being that you didn't want. Since different people were coming would take over your spot subsequently, you didn't want to leave any problems for the next person coming in, and you didn't know what plot you would have the next year. You might change around. You might not. When we were just starting out, there was very little organization.
Yeah.
So the first year. It wasn't certain that you were going to be able to have the same plot, the same plot site, the next year.
Yeah.
So people were very conscious of that, and I think it was again just we just set up some rules. No, don't use any insecticide. And I for just starting out those first 2 years. We didn't need anything. Now, I don't know. That's probably changed. And it also changed since you... I think they must have irrigation now.
Yeah, there is irrigation there now. Yeah, I think there was beginning probably right around when you left.
Yeah, there may have been. I remember very vaguely that we were quite excited that they were going to put in a line, and then we could... You could tap off it, or at least you didn't have to carry water from the apartments. That's what we did. We carried water over.
Hand pails.
Fairly onerous.
That would take a long time. Do you know if it was the university or the city who was going to put in a...
It was the university.
It was the university.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
The city, I don't think,
it's
would
not
have
city
done it. Now, I don't know where the university tapped the water line, even. I have no idea, but... I do know that we were thinking about getting a water line in.
Yeah, and it's still, I think it may be the same pipes that were put in then that we're still using. I'm not sure. I know that when it moved to the new spot in the current location, in 16.
The new spot is quite different. I looked at it on Google Maps and that sort of thing, and it's really extensive. It's grown tremendously. It'd be fun for me to come back and see it.
It
really would.
How big would you say it was when you were gardening in it, compared proportionally to what it is now?
It was about, to start, the first year was about a quarter to a third the size of the present garden. It's essentially occupied the space where those new apartments are on that circle that runs off. I don't know the name of the street, because of course it wasn't there when I was there, and I don't see the name on Google Maps. There's this circle that runs off of Eagle Heights Drive that has a different construction of different architecture of apartments than is on the northern side of Eagle Heights Drive. There's two different, and it's those later apartments, and it was a portion of that they have.
Okay.
You look at a map. In fact, I'm going to bring it up. I'm online here.
Okay.
And I can take a look at the Google Map. The thing is that some of the streets are not...
not labeled. Yeah, I think... I'm not sure what is labeled. I don't have my computer on right now. But
just a minute.
Yeah. I do realize, I know. You remember a lot for how long ago it was. A lot of people have been, so.
Yeah, I think it was a big part of our lives, and the university was really gracious, I thought, in the whole business
lost in the online map.
Yeah, just a second here.
No problem.
Sort of like buildings. That was the area where the
Yeah.
The area that is presently the gardens, mm-hmm. Just to the Lake Mendota Drive, I believe, was single lane. It wasn't a double lane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As it is now. But it was just open fields, mm-hmm. and there was nothing. There was nothing there. Where the gardens are now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it was even wooded. I think it was an old barn field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things that was so nice about the university plowing Landworth mm-hmm. was the field that they plowed right there, right up next to Eagle Heights Drive. Mm-hmm. That plot had heavy prairie grass in it.
Mm.
And it was almost impossible to turn.
Yeah.
It would have been an enormous amount of work for us to actually get gardens in there.
Yeah.
Because the prairie grass roots go down 50 feet.
Yeah.
And the university plowed it and tilled it mm-hmm. and raked it, did mm-hmm. everything by a tractor. And I'm sure I took some pictures of that, but I cannot find them. I've looked.
Oh, too bad.
Yeah, I must have them somewhere. I'm still an amateur photographer, but I don't know where they are.
Oh, I would love to see any pictures.
I'm still trying to find them.
Okay.
They're tucked away.
Okay.
Of course, they're regular photographs. Mm-hmm. I think. I was not doing color slides at that point. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I had black and white, so mm-hmm. they'd be okay.
Yeah.
And the row of apartment buildings that is right adjacent to the Eagle Heights Mound were not there at that point mm-hmm. in time. The forest came all the way down right to the edge of the gardens.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just... So it was a relatively small plot.
Mm-hmm.
There are sites that have, you must be able to get old aerial photographs mm-hmm. of that area before those apartments were built. And
yeah.
I'll bet you can find the old outlines of the garden. But
yeah.
I would guess, just looking at it right now, my guess is that it was, I would say, a quarter mm-hmm. to a third the size of the present gardens.
Yeah, yeah, so.
That's about right.
Probably about 100.
Yes,
100
about
or so
100
people,
plots.
100 plots.
I don't think it was quite 100. I think it was something like 80
mm-hmm.
eventually. The year we left, that sticks in my mind.
Yeah.
It was all we could manage.
Mm-hmm.
And especially after we discovered this area where we couldn't mm-hmm. get things to grow. It was a desolate area.
dead spots in the garden.
Yeah, a dead spot. It was just... And we couldn't figure out what it was from.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of a spill. Or... They dumped stuff there, taking stuff out at one point in time. But
mm-hmm.
you couldn't tell the spot until you tried to grow something there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, goodness. So how did people... So you're talking about a garden committee? Was it just...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did people volunteer to be on that committee?
You just volunteered.
Okay.
Yeah.
About how many people was it?
Boy... There was, we all fit into one room, so mm-hmm. there was probably it was more than half a dozen and could have been up to a dozen people.
Mm-hmm.
And we just were assigned various jobs,
mm-hmm.
Volunteered ourselves. I'll lay out the plots. I'll try to make arrangements for the plowing.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go talk to the university. It was all self-selected,
mm-hmm.
kind of arranged. I had very when Ann and I started have to tell you that I was not the main instigator. I didn't have any idea that the university would come and plow.
Yeah.
So, and in fact, I'm sure that was Ian's idea, or he was on the committee that, mm-hmm. that did that. I hope you can find and talk to Ian. I'm pretty sure he's still kicking.
Okay.
and he was. You can find his name through the chemistry department, as he must be an alumnus.
Okay.
University alumnus.
Okay.
And he was. I think truly the instigator of the whole thing, and I've just sort of followed along because my wife was interested.
Uh-huh.
We're pretty preoccupied. I was studying hard.
Yeah.
We all were. I mean, it was time taken out to build the gardens, mm-hmm. and get them going. But that was kind of recreational too, mm-hmm. because everybody helped one another.
Mm-hmm.
But I had no inkling that the university would then come in and you know, plow the fields for us.
Yeah.
And that, uh-huh. I think the second year they even fertilized them. And,
wow.
Put fertilizer down and disked it in,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing. So
wow.
it turned out to be the university's cooperation was a boon to us, because otherwise we would have just struggled,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. cutting the grass, getting the dirt, getting the ground turned over.
Yeah.
And with two young kids and trying to do your thesis and get everything done, doing the experimental work of those of us that were doing experimental kinds,
mm-hmm.
of things. But everybody, my next door neighbor at that time, and I can't think of his name, he was in large animal
mm.
husbandry, doing and getting his PhD in
mm.
that. He went eventually to the University of Iowa.
Hmm.
And the Iowa experiment station, and we shared back and forth. I asked my wife. We sat down together to try to get names together, but
mm.
couldn't do that for that long ago.
Yeah.
Everybody chipped in, even though everybody was also working pretty hard. But we
mm-hmm.
it was sort of a recreational kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
more than for the food.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a chance to meet with people, and
mm-hmm.
it was good workout for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. To get out in the garden and dig.
Yep. Yep. Pull weeds.
Yeah.
Did you have a lot of weed problems?
Yes, we did. Yes. With a lot of weed problems.
Yeah.
And hoeing was, you became a master at it. You learned how to do it. The soil in that place, in that spot, was not the best. It was sort of clayish.
Mm-hmm.
And when it would dry out, it would dry with a, so it would not be the good black soil
yeah.
you can find in other places. I imagine the present site is much, much better.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a much better site for the gardens than our initial choice. But it was close to us. You realize that
yeah.
it was, and the field was empty.
Yeah.
And as I say, I think there were some apple trees or
yeah.
some kind of tree in there, but they were all, and many of them were very, very old and not dying, but just so old that they were not producing anything good.
Mm-hmm.
The deer would come in occasionally,
hmm.
I think for the apples mostly,
yeah.
And they would trample a garden.
Oh, no.
Gardens. They
yep.
would come. The deer lived up on in Eagle Heights area, in that
mm-hmm.
wooded area just to the west.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that was a pretty dense area at the time.
Yeah.
There's a whole series of apartments that are now off of what's called Height Road. to the south of Eagle Heights Drive and past the new graduate student apartments.
Mm.
And that was all sort of forested area, too. Looks like it's on a hillside.
Yeah, okay.
It's to the north of Oxford Road.
Okay.
It's called Height Road. And that didn't exist either. There was nothing in there at that time.
Yeah.
So much new over the 50 years.
Yeah, there's been a lot of built up area there, most definitely.
Many changes.
Yeah.
Though there's some places that are still the same, I see.
Yeah.
Shorewood Hills was there when we were there.
Uh-huh.
We used to go down shopping in Shorewood Hills.
Yep. That makes sense. So I think there was also gardens for the faculty who were at the university houses, which I think was right south of the
that could be
garden. Did you know anything about that garden?
No, I don't.
Okay.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
When I came back in 71, we had all of our kids. We had five kids at that point in time. We got a place. We exchange homes, but it was outside of Madison.
Oh, okay.
There's a professor of physics whose home we exchanged with, and he was going on sabbatical somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I was coming on sabbatical, so we rented their house.
Yeah.
That was a different time. We didn't do any gardening at that point in time.
Yeah. We were busy enough.
Our kids were all in Madison schools.
Uh-huh.
Did well.
Nice. Good.
Excellent. We were very happy. Mm-hmm. Came back that year.
Yeah.
But then I came back to Ann Arbor.
Mm-hmm.
And I have only been there once or twice for meetings.
Uh-huh.
Occasionally, I haven't been back really to get a chance to drive around.
Yeah.
Madison has grown just enormously.
Mm-hmm.
At the time we were there, you have to realize the Frank Lloyd Wright.
Lake front, which is nice.
Yes, that's
the Beltline is.
Yeah, Beltline Highway. I wouldn't recognize Madison now.
No. No, I think some parts. I think that you'd be, well, I don't know what it looked like then, but I think you'd be surprised at the Lakeshore Nature Preserve, which are all the open areas.
Oh, yes, I do. I agree. I have two of my kids. My middle son, Eric, went to the University of Wisconsin.
Oh, nice.
Was an engineering student and graduated from Madison.
Oh, okay.
And then he was in engineering, and his wife was also a student at the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And then my daughter, who's my youngest child, was a student in German and geography at Madison, and she graduated from Madison. And I also had another son who was in architecture and design, but he went to the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee, yeah, because the architecture school is in Madison. Yeah, strange enough. University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Is there anything you thought that I might ask you about that I haven't asked you?
Yeah, and I'm sorry. The one thing about names, my wife and I both sat down, and you know, almost none of these people after 50 years, we've really had very little talk with. I don't remember their names. Most of them, and I, as far as I can tell, I don't have any. The mimeograph sheets.
that would have been great.
That I can remember of these events. I don't even know how did you get my name? I'm curious about that.
I found your name on in the old Eagle Heights newsletters. I believe you were one of the sort of representatives. Because in the Eagle Heights newsletter, there were announcements about the gardens.
Too. Yes.
And I think you were one of the people whose names was
I may have
on there.
Involved because I one of the committees was to write up a little blurb that we were to alert people that we had that we were going to try and do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was involved in composing these things. But again, I don't seem to have it. If we had any mimeograph copies, they'd all have faded by now anyway.
It's true.
They had this light blue ink that sort of disappeared over time, diffused into the paper.
Mm-hmm.
It really was a joint community effort, and lots of people, and people just pitched in.
Mm-hmm.
I know that for the 2 years that I was involved, I was... One of the major jobs was to lay out plots, and we set out. We just got a piece of rope that so we could stake out things, and we just measured out so everybody had essentially the same amount of a plot, same area covered over, and then everybody just pitched in and did their did their thing with what they wanted to do.
So how were the plots? Did you put like stakes in the corners of the plots?
Yes, okay. We put wooden stakes in the corners.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was up to people to decide whether they wanted to, and of course we had to we had to have paths so you could get from to your plot. And so there were blocks of plots together, and then usually four, and then a path running down on each side. So that, and then you had to cooperate with your neighbor, the neighboring plot, to build things. And some people went together.
Oh, okay.
They would take two plots and put them together so they could have a bigger crop
you must have had your own tools, or were tools shared?
You know, people almost they would buy a shovel or a spade, mm-hmm. or a and they just leave them out. They left them. Anybody could borrow them. You left them in your plot, people would come over and borrow them. Mm-hmm. Or rakes were the thing that would, and everybody just shared.
Yeah.
I think when we left, we left our tools there because mm-hmm. we didn't want to take them with us, and at the end of the season, people sort of collected them. At one point in time, we talked about building boxes to keep mm-hmm. them in, but mm-hmm. When I was there, I don't think that was done. Mm-hmm. It was too much work. But that may have happened later on. But at the time, just starting out, everybody just shared the tools.
Yeah.
Some people bought a rake. One family bought a rake. Another bought a spade. Another bought a little fork, a forked spade to dig a little bit. But uh-huh. the university did such a nice job of plowing and disking and cutting stuff up, and you didn't need very much. And as I say, everybody shared mm-hmm. share a rake, and mm-hmm. get things mm-hmm. to make the gardens growing.
Yeah, which is
the big problem that I remember was water at those initial stages.
Yeah,
and you have a dry period. You didn't want your flowers, plants to deteriorate. Mm-hmm. You had to carry water out in buckets. It'd be hard to do.
It'd be exhausting.
Yeah, and it was very hard to get a hose long enough. The hose was pretty expensive.
Yeah.
I had the hoses long enough to reach out into the garden.
Yeah, it wasn't right next door to everybody's house anyhow.
Yeah, you could have gotten, there were spigots on the outside. But I don't. And you would have a hose that would go to a certain distance, and then you'd carry buckets from the end of the hose to your garden because it just wasn't distributed very well.
Yeah.
So that we didn't have water in the gardens when mm-hmm. those first 2 years, mm-hmm. but there was talk about it. I know. So. Mm-hmm. And now I know they do have it.
Yeah. Now there is. Were there a lot of international students when you were gardening there?
You know, there were some, but not the density that we now have.
Mm-hmm.
There was almost all of the people involved were I would say. Mm-hmm. American, straight Americans, no mm-hmm. foreign students that I know of, although I'm sure there may have been some Asian students.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were some of those.
Yeah.
But there were not large numbers of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that has changed.
Yeah.
The graduate student population is largely, I think it's more, at Madison, it must be like it is at Ann Arbor,
mm-hmm.
mostly, largely foreign.
It's true, there is a very large international population now.
Yeah, and I will tell you one thing.
Mm-hmm.
When I originally, in 1962, when I came to the University of Michigan,
mm-hmm.
the first, we couldn't find a place to live in Ann Arbor at first, and we lived in university apartments
mm-hmm.
here for a very short time until we finally found. mm-hmm. and so forth. But there are no gardens here,
huh.
and really no place to put them initially. And there hasn't been, and I think it's largely due to the fact that Madison has an ag school mm-hmm. associated with the university, mm-hmm. and in Ann Arbor we do not. Mm-hmm. The ag school is at Michigan State in Lansing, Michigan.
Yeah.
So that difference, the climate for having university gardens has thrived in Madison,
mm-hmm.
and it's not here in Ann Arbor. Now it's much harder too. The sites are not really a site where you could have gardens here.
Yeah.
In Ann Arbor easily.
Yeah.
In the university area.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's quite interesting.
Mm. It is interesting.
But I'm really pleased to see that it's still continuing.
Yes.
the gardens look good.
I think
from an aerial.
From Google Maps. Do you have any questions for me about what the gardens are like now? I do have a plot. I do have a plot. Yeah.
Now, do you keep that plot for the total time you're in the same plot, or do you change off every year?
Mm.
Or does your position change?
It's,
do you keep your plot for the year?
You can keep your plot for the year. I think one of the biggest differences now is that the university doesn't plow any of the land anymore.
Oh, really?
So I think that changed about 10... I haven't figured out exactly when. I believe it's very recent. So when you plant things, you can have the same plot for years and years and years at a time.
Oh, that's nice.
So people plant, there are raspberries and rhubarb and asparagus, you know, so there are a lot of perennial plants that now you can have. So you can put up structures too, and they don't get taken down every year.
That's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I applaud that. I think that helps foster people sort of owning their land and taking much better care of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we had thought about doing that, but it was so temporary.
Mm-hmm.
Because even at the time, we knew that eventually apartments were going to be built on the plot that we were mm-hmm. working on. That was already clear, but
yeah.
while there was nobody there, while mm-hmm. nothing was being done with the land, we thought, well, might as well use it for growing stuff on.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked out very well. And the fact that the university even, and as I said, we had no idea that the university would even, and they jumped in enthusiastically, yeah. I would say. The administration was just great about helping their graduate students out. I think Madison has a very different climate.
Hmm.
Than does, I don't want to say political climate, but very mm-hmm. different climate than does Ann Arbor.
Mm-hmm.
They really, I always have felt that the Madison campus, that the climate of opinion that exists is always one that is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Here, the students and the faculty, too, I would say, are very ambitious
mm-hmm.
and very bright. And as they are in Madison, I think the yeah. world of Madison. I know most of the chemistry people in Madison still, and interact with them from time to time.
Oh, sure,
and
yeah.
I think, but the student climate. And my son. Eric mm-hmm. went to the University of Wisconsin as an undergrad, mm-hmm. and then he did his graduate work. He got his master's degree in engineering
mm-hmm.
Here at the University of Michigan,
mm-hmm.
and he told me once. said at the University of Wisconsin, if you're not doing well academically, or everybody is there trying to help you, everybody's rooting for you, mm-hmm. trying to give you confidence and everything. Mm-hmm. But it's intense, but it's intense in a helpful manner. Mm-hmm. But at the University of Michigan, the academic climate is very, very intense, but everybody seems to be crawling over back to get to the dock. It's not really as helpful and as generous. And, mm-hmm. and I think there's an element of that. Every campus, every university has such a different way of doing things.
Yes.
Different way of operating.
Very true.
Yeah. Where did you do your undergraduate? At Madison?
No, I actually went to Swarthmore.
Yeah. Okay, I know it.
Yeah.
But that's a different climate.
Very different climate.
Very different climate. You'll recognize it.
Yeah.
And of course, those climates change over time.
They're
really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. I think how these operate.
Yeah, it's part of the sort of how the institution has reacted to the garden over time is something I'm trying to get at too, which is
politically, it's interesting to me. As I say, mm-hmm. The thing that just astounded I think all of us was mm-hmm. the enthusiastic reception of the administration mm-hmm. when posed with the problem of in helping out the graduate students mm. To make life better for them mm-hmm. in many, many different ways. I mm-hmm. think that they didn't even realize how much help that was mm-hmm. to many of the people.
Yeah.
And to do so enthusiastically. I mean,
yeah.
You know, all we were asking, we would have dug the plots. We didn't expect them to plow. We didn't expect them to come through and do it every year and mm-hmm. clean up stuff and they put a lot of effort into it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That was.
Do you know what level of the administration it was that was doing? I mean, was it the College of Agriculture or the Housing Division? You're not sure.
Oh, no. And okay. I believe it was the It must have been the College of Agriculture mm-hmm. because I think they were the ones that owned or that had that property. Okay. And certainly they were the ones who brought the plows in, the ag school people, mm-hmm. and did the plowing. It didn't take them long to do, but mm-hmm. and it was very little, didn't require a huge amount of effort, but it was that the decision to actually do it that was mm-hmm. so great, and they jumped at the chance.
That's really good. Did you pay for the plots that you had, or were they free?
No.
Okay.
Nothing. They just
nice.
And they left the decisions about how big the plots were to be and everything mm-hmm. to the committee mm-hmm. that started it, that I was on, and I believe the plots were, when we started out, they were a little, the first year they were too small. Mm. We had more people than we expected, and the area of ground that we had plowed was too small, so that we filled the space completely. Mm-hmm. The next year we had a larger area plowed mm-hmm. and to accommodate. We had a better idea how many people wanted to have plots mm-hmm. and we increased the size. The size nice. Initially was really pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Trying to think about. And they were rectangular in shape.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't square.
Yeah.
But I don't know how. okay. And what the size was.
That's okay. I'm getting an idea of what it looked like anyhow.
So. It could have been... no, I can't figure it.
That's okay.
I don't know what the size was.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
You may be able to find that out, actually.
Yeah. I think I may have seen it in the Eagle Heights newsletter,
yeah,
so I'm going to go back.
We specified it originally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we noticed that we were setting out.
Mm-hmm.
So people and we didn't also figure big enough paths originally. The first year, the paths were too narrow between the gardens. And we were trying to conserve, of course, on the space.
Yeah. So you widened those.
So we widened them, yes.
Nice.
The next year. And that was part of the reason to plow it the second time. We felt that we need to, and also that spot where things didn't grow, I think there was probably a dozen people out of the group that I didn't get anything. It was just complete bare spot. Nothing came up. Now, it may have been just a simple fact that had been a bunch of fertilizer had been dumped there, and it's just too high a concentration of fertilizer. I don't know. Nobody knows.
Yeah.
We never figured out what the problem was. If you get too high a concentration of nitrogen, you dump a bunch of ammonium nitrate in a spot, wash it in, nothing will grow, even though it's just fertilizer.
It is too high, dangerous for plants.
So that was it.
Okay.
When did they build the new apartments there on the south side of Eagle Heights Drive?
Well, I'm not sure. They were building apartments throughout the 60s, I believe.
Okay, yes.
And so it was probably around... They were built... different groups of hundreds were at different times.
Yeah.
If you lived in the 700s?
You can see big difference in architecture changes from the north side of Eagle Heights Drive to the south side of Eagle Heights Drive. There's that big, huge circle area that has, they look like hexagons from above.
Mm-hmm.
And they look like they're quite nice.
Well, I think you may be talking about the university houses. I don't have a map in front of me
right
now. But I'm not sure. I can.
It could be. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's hard from up above to see. I see they have that architecture, that same kind of architecture.
Mm-hmm.
They have from looking at them from above, the apartments look just like straight barns, barn type buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the ones that I lived in.
Yeah.
The buildings that are sort of wrapped around, making hexagons or partial hexagon points. Those are the ones that are the new ones, and they're in several spots. There's also one over on right next to Lake Monona Drive, Lake Mendota Drive. Right at the corner of the bend there, as it goes out towards Eagle Heights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're probably just later.
Yeah,
later
there's. You can see all kinds of different architectures. You can actually tell just from the color of the roofs which ones are the old ones and which ones are the new ones.
That's great.
Actually,
that's great.
Kind of interesting. Is the old Eagle Heights mound? Is that they're going to keep that? They're not going to build anything up there, right?
No, that's going to stay. That's part of the Lakeshore Nature Preserve.
Yeah, okay, good.
Woods.
That's
very wooded still, and you can walk walk up. You can walk up the hill. I think it's called Eagle Heights Woods now, something.
I see. And they still have the old Indian mounds up there on the top?
They do. They're very. They're all covered in trees right now.
I see.
So yeah. You can't see them
anymore. Well, there were trees all around, but you could easily make them out.
They're even more wooded now. Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Lots of oaks, I see. Mm-hmm. You can spot big oaks. And there were lots of oaks coming. There was almost like a oak savanna.
Yeah.
Even when we were there. But yeah. There was not a lot of undergrowth. They had, the oak savanna has probably been invaded by lots of other species now, so.
Yeah.
That changes things.
Mm-hmm. It has. They're working on clearing it, some parts of it out. They want a more free oak savanna,
right.
True oak savanna. But that takes a lot of work with all the undergrowth that's in there.
Thorns and honeysuckle get in.
Yeah.
Makes a big problem.
Yeah.
We have we were very intrigued by. The time we were there by the prairie there in Madison, and when we came to Ann Arbor, the place where we live, which is just outside of Ann Arbor in what's called Scio Township, we live very close to the railroad tracks and the Detroit to Chicago Amtrak train, about 2 acre lots away. It runs the Amtrak train runs along the rail, runs along the river. Mm-hmm. We're in the river valley.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And but all along this area is a tall grass prairie. Runs and in fact the tall grass prairie runs almost all the way from Detroit to Chicago.
Oh, wow.
All along the tracks because when we first came out here, they were still running the freight trains that would run along the track would oftentimes have cars that didn't have ball bearings in them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had what are called a hot box, a dripping box of oil or grease. Actually, it was hard grease. And as the spindle rotated in the gap in the track for the wheels turning, the spindle would heat up, and the grease would melt down and then lubricate the bar. These train cars without any ball bearings at all would travel all the way from Detroit, actually from Canada, over to Chicago.
Wow. Yeah.
And every once in a while, their grease box would run out of grease, and the spindle would then get very, very hot, low red hot, and it would shoot sparks out along the side of the tracks. And this would set fire to the prairie grass. The prairie grass would burn. And you'd have fires going between Detroit and Chicago all along the tracks. And they burned quite, and we were quite close to those.
Oh,
and
wow.
The community here that where we live, it's near an old village called Foster, would get out and to put out the fires. It would burn. Progresses. Mm-hmm. Well, the fires are the thing that sustain the progress. Everything else burns off along with the prairie grass. But the prairie grass, because it has such deep roots, is not affected, and it grows back again. So the prairie grasses are sustained all along the tracks, and you can still see that in a train ride between Detroit and Chicago. You'll see vast areas where along the tracks you'll have huge stands of big blue stem and little blue stem prairie grass.
Wow. Beautiful.
And so we have actually, to sustain that, we transplanted, we would So a vast area of our backyard, not including part very close to the house and parts where the garden is, is now prairie grass.
Oh, how beautiful!
The big blue stem is the thing that is just, and we burn it off every 2 years or so, and have a big fire. And Madison does the same thing, you know, in their prairie.
Yeah.
They have to burn in order to sustain it.
Yeah.
And they'll have a big prairie. If you have never gone to their prairie grass burn, you should take, and you're interested in ecology, you can take a look at it. It's fun to go to. See.
Yeah. And they are trying to, that's another part of this story that I'm trying to construct, is they're putting in prairies around the garden by the biology department. And so how you balance prairie grasses with this garden that's always disturbed. And they're having a really hard time actually establishing a prairie.
Yes, because they're very hard to establish. Mm-hmm. And it takes up, all I would say is it takes a long, long time.
Yeah.
And it does take this, you think, once you get the prairie grass up in a particular spot, you think that you don't want to burn it because you want to sustain it, but you have to burn it in order for it to be sustained.
Yeah.
It's like many ecological things, the fire is a thing that helps. Mm-hmm. It keeps out all the other things except the prairie. The prairie keeps going.
So it's they're working on it. They've established little small pieces, but they're trying some more. They brought in some big equipment a few weeks ago to mow in a spot where they're going to try to establish, because they're stopping the weeds from seeding.
Yeah, I see.
That are there right now. So they chopped off all the seed heads and collected something from the Western Ag Station came, and there was a huge mower and a truck was backing up behind it all around the field, so the mower would just shoot all the weed seeds into the truck, so none of it landed.
So they take them away.
Yeah, so they took them away. It was quite an operation to watch.
When I was at Abbott Diagnostics down in North Chicago area, Abbott, I was working as a chemist, doing chemistry for Abbott as a called an internal consultant. My research work is on I don't know how to, it won't make much sense to you. It's called protein cross-linking agents. I work on things to be used in diagnostic medicine.
Okay.
Attaching probes to proteins and so forth.
Follow them while they're probes, so you can follow the proteins through
you can follow mostly for antibodies.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So you can attach the probe to an antibody so it's either colored or fluorescent or radioactive.
Yeah, depending on what the protein is interacting with.
And then the antibody will attach to it's raised against a particular cell type, and the antibody will stick to that particular cell. Mm-hmm. So you because the antibody is carrying a tag, the cell then becomes labeled. So if you had a cancer of some kind, and you raise the antibody against the cell of that particular cancer, you can then tag that particular cell by using that antibody. And so it's used for diagnostic testing. It could also be used potentially for therapy, but that's much harder to do. But anyway, when I was in Chicago, in that area there, there in Lake County, they have a huge number of and they do an extremely good job of sustaining their prairies there. They have a very, very extensive area, and the public doesn't realize and know how much and there are they actually go out and they collect prairie grass seed, civet, and collect the seeds, so it's quite pure, and then broadcast it on in areas. And the Lake County ecology people have done just a terrific job in promoting their areas, and they've sustained huge numbers of oak savannas, that are almost impossible to get to, actually. You don't even know that they are there, and owned by conservation groups. And they are working very hard to sustain their prairie grass areas, as well as the oak savannas. Mostly they mostly try to grow sedges underneath the oak trees.
Oh, yeah.
So you don't have grass, you have sedge.
Yeah.
Very different kind of ecological prospect.
Yeah. Fascinating. That's good.
Well, you can always give me a call back again. I'll send you some stuff by email.
Oh, that would be great. I forgot to ask if I can use your real name or if I should use a pseudonym if I'm...
Oh, you can use my real name.
Okay.
Sure.
I don't think...
Everybody, it's... I'm mostly known as... that's Richard G. Lawton, but everybody knows me by Rich Lawton, just so the distraction. But either one is fine.
Either one.
I don't mind at all.
Great. And I'm sure that if I have questions once I think, then I will definitely either call again or send you an email.
Of course, the one demand I have is that I see your final thesis report as a PDF document or something.
Certainly. I would love to. And if you have any other questions for me, please feel free to email.
Okay, great.
Yep. If you're in town, let me know.
Thanks. It'll be fun to meet.
Garden.
Good. Bye-bye.
Bye.